You're listening to a sermon by Janice Kreider, recorded on Sunday, August 3rd, 2008, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Some years ago, when Evan's parents were living in their house in Goshen, Indiana, their next-door neighbor was fixing his car in his garage, and he was underneath the car. There was some kind of hoist that was holding it up, and as you can guess, it fell down on him. And so his wife ran over to Evan's parents' house and got them and their teenage son, and they went over there, and between the, or among the four of them, they picked up this car, and the man was all right, I guess. Pretty much okay. But in the meantime, a great aunt who was retired in the area decided to drop in on Evan's parents, and she got to the house, and they had either, I think, possibly left the door open or unlocked, and that wasn't very characteristic. And she walked in, and she could see that people were around, but nobody was there. So maybe you can guess where this is going. She concluded that the rapture had happened. And even though she was a Christian and had been a missionary in Korea, that she was left behind. So the family got a lot of amusement out of that. Now, I don't know about you, but these popular left behind books, I stay as far away from them as I can. I don't really like the genre. Now, today I chose this parable. Well, the worship committee gave me a choice of three. I could do all three. But I chose this one because it's longer, has more meat to it, and also it's about women, and I thought maybe I could learn something about that. But it turns out to be a left-behind story. So here we are. Now, this parable has a number of puzzling things or problems that sort of can bother you. And the first one, and I think the most important one, is that the door is shut on these five so-called foolish women, even though they ended up getting oil. They had their oil, but they still couldn't get into the wedding feast. The second puzzling thing is, why didn't the five wise women share their oil? And the third puzzling thing is verse 13 doesn't fit exactly with the story. And the fourth puzzling thing is that there's no mention at all of a bride. So I'm going to look at these first three problems or puzzling things and then add some further ideas that come out of the parable. So the first one, the door is shut. Even though the five foolish women ended up with their oil, it doesn't seem fair to us. And if that's the case with you, it doesn't seem fair with me. If that's the case with you, well, you're in good company. Thomas Merton apparently didn't think it was fair either. And he wrote a poem, and it was in French. And it's translated here by an American feminist, so she may have taken some liberties. I don't know, because I couldn't find the original French version. But here's how it goes. It's called The Five Virgins, and he dedicated it to someone named Jacques. There were five virgins, rowdies, who arrived for the wedding of the Lamb, with their motor scooters burned out and their gas tanks empty. But since they knew how to dance, they were told to stick around anyhow. So that's it. There were five rowdy virgins without gas, but really caught up in the action. Then there were 10 virgins at the wedding of the Lamb. So it takes a few liberties there. Now we, like Merton, we would prefer the wide open banquet invitation, like we had last Sunday in the parable that Paul talked about. And the wedding invitation was extended to people on the street and even to people like us, Gentiles. Now, another reason that I feel it's not fair that these women ended up being rejected is that they were actually not women yet. Probably they were about 12 years old. I don't see our local 12-year-old here today. But in those days, it was just before marriageable age. And so they're younger than many of our junior bridesmaids today. And the bridesmaids isn't really a good translation here. So I'm going to use girls in the rest of the talk. And we know that Jesus welcomed children, and these were still sort of children at the end of childhood. So why were these young women, still girls, given such a hard time? Now, we know that, we don't know what the customs of the day would have been around weddings, but it's very probable that the celebration would have been open to everybody in the village. And you know how your own invitations for weddings just becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. You want to include everybody. And it doesn't make sense that the doorkeeper, who may or may not have been the bridegroom, says, "I don't know you." And that has to have been a lie and has to have been not very characteristic. But we don't know for sure. The second puzzling thing is why the five wise girls didn't share their oil. And again, that doesn't seem fair. And it's interesting, some commentators just say, oh, you know, this isn't anything you should worry about. This is part of the story. Just go on. And others hone in on this. And I don't know about you, but it's something that bothers me, why they didn't share their oil. Now, I was going to do something clever with Matthew 11:19, where it says, wisdom is vindicated by her deeds, and link that wisdom in with these five wise girls. And wisdom in 11:19 has a feminine adjective or whatever pronoun. So I thought, let's link those together, and it'll be very interesting. However, that would have been stupid, because they are two different words. Not in our language, but in Greek. And the wisdom in Luke 19 and Matthew 11, no, Luke 7 and Matthew 11, is a different kind of wisdom. It's in the Greek, it's Sophia. And it's a wisdom that's applied to Jesus and God, and it's sometimes called a divine wisdom. Whereas the wise or wisdom that these young girls have is more translated as prudent, or maybe we could say pragmatic. In other words, it's the cholesterol-free version. It's a light version of wisdom. It's still wisdom, but it's not as deep. So this parable is not a lesson on the golden rule. The prudent girls weren't in solidarity with the other five, and they didn't say, oh, come along, there'll be enough light with our five lamps. And one commentator sarcastically asks, is the kingdom of heaven about women at war with each other over oil? As I said before, we don't know the exact wedding customs of those days, but it's possible that the girls were part of a procession which would start at the bride's house. They would all gather there, and then the bridegroom would come and pick everybody up. And everybody would go to the bridegroom's home, where the celebration would take place and where the girl would be living forever after. And this procession may have included dancing lit by the lamps, so sort of an art form in a way. So the five wise girls recognized their role, and they knew that they needed to provide light for the entire procession. And if they didn't have enough oil, they would fall down on their tasks. The end of the procession, they'd be in the dark. It could be. There was that risk. So like not enough wine, not enough light during the procession would have a noticeable impact on the celebration and probably result in shame on the family for not getting it right. So the door was closed. Even though the foolish girls picked up oil at the store, because it was too late for them to do their job. They were foolish in a number of ways. One is they simply failed at their task. Another is that they assumed that they could rely on others. and they assumed that they would be accepted even though they messed up. Now, the third puzzling thing that I mentioned was verse 13. How it doesn't fit. Keep watch because you do not know the day or the hour. Well, watch means stay awake. And none of the girls stayed awake. So the verse doesn't seem to line up with the situation in the parable. But if we look at Matthew 24, the previous chapter, we find that this theme of keeping watch is sprinkled throughout there. In Matthew 24:4, Jesus said, "Watch out that no one deceives you." And in verses 42 to 44, "Keep watch because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have left his house be broken into." And then verse 50, "The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour he's not aware of." So that verse 13 is a literary device bringing some unity to these two chapters. And some commentators think that it was added later, and that's why it probably doesn't apply exactly to the situation of the parable in question. Now some further thoughts on the parable. There's a folly of relying on others, of not taking our own responsibility, of a superficial commitment of just going along with the others. And that's what the five girls did, the foolish ones. The five wise girls showed their wisdom by their responsible action, preparing to have enough oil. But the five foolish girls were caught off guard. They were caught off by surprise in a way. And sort of like the surprised people in Matthew 25, verses 44 to 45, who say, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and did not help you?" And he will reply, "I tell you the truth. Whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. And we have numerous present-day examples of foolish people, if you want to call them that, aligning themselves with Christianity or with the institutional church and bringing some shame to our religion. So second thing here is the need to keep aware but not on red alert. All the 10 girls slept, and that was not where they erred. But the five wise girls were aware of what was important during that time, and they had their preparations of oil. The next parable in this chapter has a similar lesson. It's the parable of the talents, 5, 2, and 1, and what the servants did with them when their master was on holidays. And the lesson is that the period of waiting should be used responsibly, and doing nothing isn't acceptable. Now, the parables in chapters 24 and 25 were told to the disciples, and that's in contrast to some other parables, and I think possibly next week's parable, which might be the vineyard parable. I don't know. I guess it looks like it is. And that was told to the Pharisees. So there's some different lessons to be learned. And the parables told to the disciples, well, particularly the one today, it encourages them to persevere and to stick with it in the long run. And that was a very valuable lesson for the early church as well. Now, there are kind of three levels, ways to look at the parables. One is to look at the core of what Jesus said and what it might have meant in those days to those people who listened. And the next level is it's written down by Matthew and Luke or whoever, and they wrote it down in light of early church experiences. And then the third level is allegorical aspects. And it's hard for us in the 21st century to get through these levels and get down to the core of what Jesus said. But that is what the worship committee passed out this book by John Miller, A Mennonite, and that's what he emphasizes, getting down to the core of what Jesus tried to communicate. And that's also what a lot of other theologians try to emphasize. Now, I'd like to read this is an American theologian by the name of Dan Ottavia. I don't know much about him, but an emphasis that the being aware in the present is important, and not just the future. What is the meaning of the 10 maidens waiting for the groom? The fact that the expected event, which gives purpose and content to the present, really does lie in the future, means that the present is marked off from the future as something also real. They cannot make the groom come. They can only wait for him. Therefore, the present is not a time which is to be exhausted by straining to realize the future. There is time and room to live now. One may sleep. The present, then, as time and room to live, is a gift. But it is also a demand, for uncertainty about when the future event will happen gives to the present a certain urgency. The maidens may sleep, but they must have sufficient oil to light the way of the groom. One may live fully in the present, but one must be attentive to the need for resources to meet a future challenge. In the case of the five maidens, as contrasted with the situation of those who were waiting for Godot, someone did come, and in fact the very one they were expecting, but they were caught unprepared. Gift and demand are held paradoxically together. To see the present as gift alone, the folly of the five, is to be deprived by the future of any present at all. And then another sort of similar thing from a German theologian, Louise Schottroff. Parables expect a response. That is what Jesus urges at the end of the parable. Keep awake. That's the verse 13. The last scene of the parable image leaves the hearers behind in a gloomy situation. The door is closed to the young girls. I do not know you. The response of the hearers can only be, but we know you, and we will receive you. The door is not closed. We still have time to put an end to violence. The parable does not end with a description of a condition, but with a challenge. The hearers can also hear God's promise in it. The listening community knows what it has to do. It can keep awake and recognize that now there is still time to act according to God's will. This eschatology does not speculate about who at the judgment will stand before closed doors or who will be saved. It opens up the present and transforms it into a time of hearing and acting. Okay, the parable is a reminder that some of our actions are irreversible and injustice can be a result. We all have our own examples of things we've done that we wish we could undo, but in life, there's no Microsoft undo icon. I don't know about Apple if it has undo icons. Probably does. But we don't have one in life. And so sometimes there's no way you can repair the damage. In this age of awaiting the kingdom of heaven, failures and injustice are part of the bad stuff that happens, along with famines and earthquakes. We pray your kingdom come, but there are still failures and injustice, like what the servant who is supposed to give other servants their food does while the master is away in Matthew 24:49. He then begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. In today's parable, we see the failures of the five foolish girls and the injustice when they are not admitted to the celebration, even though they attempted to amend their ways. Now I've got some questions. Were the five wise girls also foolish? I would like to argue that their wisdom was not of the highest level. Of course, they did the pragmatic thing, keeping their oil for themselves, and thus fulfilling their task and ending up at the party. So they were okay. But it wasn't wise to tell the other five to go and buy their own oil at that hour of the night. People in Jesus' day listening to the story may have thought that that was foolish advice, that there were 10 foolish girls. What was the effect of the five wise girls' decision on their future relationship in the village with the other five girls? What kind of future relationship would the five excluded girls have with the bridegroom and his family? Or we can think about the relationship of the five wise girls with the bridegroom for excluding their friends. Did the bridegroom benefit by performing a negative act during their joyful celebrations? Now, these kind of breakdowns in relationships are very difficult to reverse. They keep counselors in business. Was this decision by the five wise girls in the end the best thing that could have happened? So a question that I have is for us is, are there instances today where doing the more reasonable, sensible, or pragmatic thing results in the exclusion of others from the kingdom of heaven? And I'm going to repeat that question. I think it's a very good question for us as people of privilege globally and in our society. Are there instances today where doing the more reasonable, sensible, or pragmatic thing results in the exclusion of others from the kingdom of heaven? So, in conclusion, we're supposed to be prepared, we're supposed to be awake, we're supposed to be watching. And what's the content of what we're supposed to be looking for? Well, I think Paul Thiessen's challenging conclusion of last week fits here as well. He talked about changing into a new garment, a garment that has us emphasizing fruits of the Spirit, peace, justice, reverence, and worship, caring for the poor, the bottom of the pile. Basically, it's the gospel. Looking after the least of these of chapter 25. Jesus' succinct words are, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." We're not meant to do this in a superficial or only pragmatic way, and that's what we shouldn't forget.